Thanks for joining us on Gulf Coast Life. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. This week, we hear from Dr. Karen Tang, a board-certified gynecologist and minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon. She's the author of the new book, It's Not Hysteria, Everything You Need to Know About Your Reproductive Health But Were Never Told. It's a comprehensive guide to treatment options and common conditions, many of which are under-discussed and misunderstood. Dr. Tang is well known for posting videos on social media dispensing medical wisdom where people have access to it. I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk with Dr. Karen Tang today. Dr. Tang, welcome to Gulf Coast Life.
Thank you so much, Carrie. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you for being here. It's a great pleasure. Okay, let's start with the big picture. What inspired you to write this book, It's Not Hysteria?
Yeah, so in my day job, my focus is on situations where someone has been probably misunderstood and not heard and sometimes like outright ignored for many, many years. So my focus is mostly on like chronic pelvic pain. And over the years, it's sort of expanded to add perimenopause and menopause. And a lot of these situations, women were basically just literally suffering for years. Like on average, endometriosis takes 7 years to get a diagnosis, you know, sometimes excruciating pain.
Wow.
And every single patient I was seeing would basically be like, you know, I had all these problems. I was, you know, suffering, and I would tell my doctor, and they would say, that's normal. Like this. And those of you who are joining us because you're interested in perimenopause, menopause probably are nodding, because a lot of these things are sort of passed off as these are just a part of being a woman. It's like your like lot in life to suffer with, you know, horrible periods and bleeding and pain and hormone stuff. And it gets sort of passed off as like, this is just normal. And a lot of these situations, it's not just normal. It's a, you know, a medical situation where there's a diagnosis, like there's a condition, there are treatment options, there are studies, you know, sometimes there's not as many studies as in things like, you know, cancer and heart disease, but there's some. And a lot of people were sort of being treated as if it was just like either an annoyance or you're being too anxious or you're over exaggerating. And, you know, people really not getting the information they deserved. And so that led to me starting on social media. I'm by nature not someone who's like, I love to like go make TikToks, but I was just so... So kind of motivated by the experiences of the patients I was seeing, like I really felt someone needed to get out there and tell people, you know, these are not normal. Like if you're having X, Y, and Z symptoms, this could be PCOS, it could be PMDD, it could be endometriosis, and just to raise awareness and then also bring some of this information out so people can actually get the care they need. That has led to me, you know, using my platform to educate about those things as well. And that's obviously led to me seeing more of these patients in my office. And it, across the country, it's really part of this movement to, you know, not be silent anymore, not just sort of accept that this is women's lot in life, and to demand more answers and more scientific explanations about, you know, what's going on with my body. What can I do about it? Is there something I can do to, you know, relieve some of the horrible symptoms I'm having? And so, you know, very naturally that led to writing the book. By nature, I'm definitely more somebody who's like, let me just sit and like write something that rather than get in front of a camera and make a TikTok about it. But whatever format I can reach people, I'm going to use it. So, you know, a lot of people who are younger are going to be using, you know, the TikTok and Reels and YouTube, and other people are going to be like, I'd rather just like have a book. Like I'd rather go to the library or go to my local bookstore and have the resource so I can kind of look through it on my own time. And the book is nice because it contains literally something about everything. So if you've had a question about any aspect of your gynecologic health, you know, your bladder, vagina, sexual health, hormones, you know, how do I advocate for myself with my doctor? It's in the book. So I wanted to have a all-in-one resource for people to be able to get their questions answered.
Yes, that's great. It certainly is that. And it's very easy to read. And I know people are like scared of books. they're scared of reading. You know, you can just go straight to what your question is about or straight to what your pain is about and get some good information. So I really love your book.
We called it Choose Your Own Adventure. So I was like, right in the beginning, I'm like, I know you're not going to sit and read this whole book cover to cover. It's not like a novel. But if you're like, okay, I really want to learn about X, like, you know, you can just flip right to that chapter, learn about it, maybe come back to it another day when you have another question about something.
Yeah.
Don't be scared. Books are great. We love books.
I just am curious to hear your take on, like, why do you think there's so much pain that's dismissed in women? And there's so much, as you said, like actual medical issues that are just not discussed, or there's so much misinformation. I mean, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I talk a little bit about in the book, and I'm writing a second book now on hormones. And I kind of in the beginning reflect on like, why are things so bad? Like, how did it get to this point? I always make the case that if the same things are happening to men, so for instance, like with menopause, like if your penis started to hurt and you couldn't have sex and you started, losing your memory and you couldn't sleep and your bones were aching, and you were just feeling like you were just drenched in sweat all the time, we would have more answers and more, open discussions. And there would be a lot less of this, mystery, like nature about it. But somehow for women's health, a lot of this has sort of been turned into, well, like there's been a normalization of female pain, and that goes across the board. So, not just physical pain, but, with periods, with sex, pain, like emotional pain, mood stuff sort of gets fobbed off as, oh, that's just your time of the month, or women are so emotional. So it's been normalized to the extent that it's not treated like actual medical care. So, for instance, like people talk about when they look at research funding. Obviously, everybody thinks heart attacks and diabetes and strokes and cancers are real medical stuff. It's important. We got to put funding towards it. Everything else is like, oh, it's just sort of an annoyance, or it's just like women overreacting. Why would we put more money towards it? Why would we invest lots of NIH dollars into it? And so, with that, like a sort of a self-perpetuating cycle, you have lack of information, you have lack of resources, you really don't have a whole wide range of options for people. And then it sort of just perpetuates.
Oh, I was just going to add that the legislators who are allocating the money too are like old, typically old men who will never know what you're talking about. Or, yeah, it's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate, and I hope to see some change.
Yeah, it's actually getting worse. I mean, recently where they had sort of the keywords that were being used to basically eliminate funding or to dismiss proposals for funding for research altogether, and includes literally like the word like woman and female, but not men and male. So I made a video about this. I'm like, yeah, there's like clearly like there's a clear, outright disparity in what they're doing in terms of funding. And I belong to lots of discussion boards of female doctors, and people are like, yeah, like my NIH grant was terminated because I talk about like, Black women's health and things like that. So we're gonna keep fighting for change. It's not looking great right now. But things like this, talking about menopause and the movement behind it, it's sort of the only thing that we can do. Like, this is sort of a bipartisan thing. It doesn't matter what political party you belong to. If you are a female and you are going to live long enough, you will hopefully go through menopause. So it sort of makes it a universal experience. Like, one would hope that there be a universal support for something that we'll all kind of go through.
Yes, and we were talking a little bit before we started recording that I mean, I am a big fan of yours because I feel that you are using social media for good.
I'm trying so hard.
That you're going where the people are. You're going where the gap in education is, and you can use these little short videos to really educate people. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. Like, how has that been a useful tool for you to educate people? And then also talked a little bit about how it can be a very destructive tool and very full of disinformation and misinformation.
Exactly. So when I started, I didn't actually do any social media before 2019. Like, I had like a Facebook, I posted about my kids, and I didn't do anything else. And a friend of mine who was very active on social media, Jessica Shepherd, we were at a conference and she was talking about how many followers, and I was like, oh, what is this that you're doing? Why are you like on Instagram and stuff? And she pointed out that this is where people get their information now. And I was so blown away because I wasn't really on social media. I had no idea. And it really became apparent in COVID that doctors and the medical profession as a whole had really missed the boat, that it wasn't that people were like, let me get my health information from my local doctor. They were going on YouTube, they're going on Reddit and Facebook, and they're just seeing what people are saying. And a lot of that is misinformation, again, as we saw in COVID times. So a lot of us doctors were like, oh, shoot, we got to get out there onto these spaces. Now I call it the forefront of public health. It's really where we need to be to get messages out to people. It's what people use to communicate, to gather information, to find communities. So I had to kind of force myself to get over my fear of social media because it was so important. And that, like you said, the flip side of that is that people who are sort of ahead of the game in terms of realizing the power of social media to monetize, like you get all these influencers doctors who they have a whole career at a, billions of dollars industry by making people scared, making people distrustful of traditional medical stuff. So you see this, with the raw milks and the anti-vaccine, and like even things like now you see people talking about like, don't get chemotherapy for your cancer. That's going to kill you. You should buy my detox, or you should buy my supplements. It's outrageous. So the reason that there's so much misinformation is, one, a lot of people profit from it, and they've gotten very good at, disguising misinformation as facts. So you throw out enough like sciencey words and people are like, wow, that person knows what they're talking about. Put the doctor in front, but they don't say that they, got a PhD from some online, whatever in like something completely unrelated to nutrition or science or, cancer treatment or anything like that. So having people who can be trustworthy experts is very important. I've, we've now kind of become friends, a lot of us at a certain level of social media, like all kind of found each other and we support each other because, having a resource that you're like, I know this person's going to the best of their ability, read the studies, explain them to me in a way I can understand, not be biased by like I'm selling this thing that I'm telling you
Right.
is the only treatment available to you and it's the only thing that's going to work and everything else is going to destroy your body. Currently, it feels like losing the fight a little bit, but I am really encouraged by the fact that people are looking for legitimate sources and they're trying to find the truth. And well, we're out there trying to reach you guys too. So hopefully
Yes.
we meet enough people that it makes a difference.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Dr. Karen Tang, board certified gynecologist and minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon. She's the author of the book, It's Not Hysteria. We are talking about reproductive health. The field of OBGYN, I feel like, is really under duress nationally. We're in Florida. I know you're in the Philadelphia area, but there's a shortage of OBGYNs in Florida. A lot of them left the state when the 6-week abortion ban went into law, which is before many women even know they're pregnant. And it seems to me like one of the threads of your book, I think, is that women have kind of been on their own in terms of gynecology, being dismissed, et cetera. And now I feel like in Florida and in many other states, they're on,
Lots of states,
yeah, they're even more on their own. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I've actually recently done a couple of presentations on what are the ramifications of some of these decisions. A lot of people, and I always kind of, frame it as they're trying to protect life. They're voting with their ethics, but a lot of people don't realize the Pandora's box that gets opened, and that is really destructive to women's health. And so I try and make it a point of explaining, why that is. And so there's a concept called maternity deserts, which is literally in counties where there is zero, like OBGYNs or labor and delivery units. Like, so literally no one can provide OBGYN care in that entire county. And it's something like a third of counties in the United States, and in some states, especially in the South and Midwest, it's half of the counties. And so this is truly a crisis. Like, and a lot of people, are like, well, it wasn't just abortion. And there's several reasons why there was already an existing crisis. So one is, malpractice for OB, and then another is just generally the reimbursement financially is very low for women's health. It goes to, the perception that women's health is not really important. And so it's basically the lowest paid surgical specialty by a long shot. And so a lot of practices and labor and delivery units closed because they just were not financially sustainable. Like, they would lose money. And so at some point the hospital decided to close their unit. A lot of OBGYN practices go out of practice because they can't keep the doors open. They are seeing a ton of patients, but still not able to pay overhead. So along comes now these strict abortion bans, and people are like, well, just don't do abortions. Abortion care is part of routine obstetric care. I think people don't realize that. And I've made the case in many of these talks that, there are some situations where there are medically necessary abortions. Like, abortion just means ending a pregnancy. It doesn't necessarily mean like somebody who purely out of, elective just doesn't want to be pregnant, which obviously is a valid reason. But just to say that the reason a lot of OBs are leaving these states is because in situations you have like a 15-week, someone breaks their water, but they're not dying yet. But, at some point, they start to get sicker. They start to have a little bit of a higher heart rate, a little bit of a higher temperature. And they start to have a little bit more pain. Still not dying yet. But at some point, within the next couple of hours, they crash. They become septic, and then they are, hemorrhaging. That doesn't, declare itself as someone is dying, not dying. And a lot of these times we make the point that, these like, oh, for the life of the mother exceptions really don't help at all, because who determines that? Like, at what point is somebody like at death's door enough? that you could legally perform an abortion and not worry. And the penalties for these are outrageous. It's literally like in Texas, it's like hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. You could lose your medical license. You become committed of a felony, convicted of a felony. So, doctors are literally waiting until somebody is like almost dead. And so now you've had some situations across, certain states with these strict abortion bans where women have died because doctors waited too long. And then like I said, it's not to blame them because, put yourself in that situation. Like, at what point do you make the call? So, in Ireland, this case occurred and a woman passed away, and it actually galvanized the whole country to reverse their abortion ban because they were so horrified that this could happen, that you literally had to wait until a woman was nearly dead, before you could legally act. And at that point, it's too late. So, yeah, I just made a presentation where, like, Idaho, I think something like a third, I have to fact check this, but something like a third of their OBGYNs like left the state after the abortion ban. I'm not sure in Florida like how many left, but people leave the state because of this. Like, why, you can't practice that way. So this then exacerbates all the, it's already hard to get a doctor. It's already impossible in some places to get an appointment. People are driving hours to give birth even. So for even things like just, like you're trying to get your HRT, you're trying to talk about menopause, there's no one there to help you. So I do tell people it's to raise awareness about what are the ramifications of these votes, when you think that it's sort of a simple, I just protect life, but you're actually making life worse. Like, you are, putting people's lives at danger. So, again, this should be like a nonpartisan thing where, maybe we like talk to experts and have experts weigh in instead of just having legislators kind of make these arbitrary cutoffs out of nowhere, that then make things much worse for the general population.
Yes, so well said. That is such an alarming situation. I mean, doctors really can't win. Patients certainly can't win. I mean, it's really.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize how bad it is out there. I didn't realize how bad it was out there until, people were like, you got these maternity deserts. I'm like, oh, what do you mean? Yeah, I'm in this little bubble in Pennsylvania where, like outside of Philadelphia, we're great. We have had, and even outside of Philadelphia, we had several hospitals close. We had several OBGYN practices close, long-standing ones, 20-something years. So even in our bubble, we're being affected. So it's not just in kind of extreme rural areas either.
Well, one thing I definitely wanted to get to is menopausal hormone therapy,
Yes.
MHT, which it used to be known as HRT, hormone replacement therapy, because the FDA made a big change about this recently. And I just want you, smart doctor that you are, to explain it to us.
Tell the story, exactly. So I always tell people, let me spin the tale. So everyone probably remembers back in 2002, this is where everything kind of changed. So before then, it was actually very common for people to get we again called it HRT, and to get it basically indefinitely because we were like, okay, we know that, before menopause, women have a lower risk of heart disease and strokes and diabetes and dementia. And then after menopause, you have all those risks increase, like your bones thin, like all these things go wrong. So why not give you hormones and basically give them indefinitely to try and prevent all of those problems? So along came a big study called Women's Health Initiative, which meant to basically on a large scale study that and confirm that that was true, that giving HRT to women kind of later in life was going to stave off some of these chronic medical conditions. A lot of people don't realize that that was the purpose of the study. So they actually ended up stopping the study early because they saw that there were increased risks of breast cancer and heart attacks and stroke and things like that. And it made massive, massive news because it was a huge study. It was the biggest study on women's health, like by far. Like, it was randomized, it was enormous. And so it just made this enormous wave in terms of the media. Like, everyone panicked. I was in my medical school, like right before my OBGYN rotation. So literally, like, everyone was scrambling because it was a total sea change from what people had been doing. And so the pendulum swung in the exact opposite direction, basically being like, no one should get HRT. It's going to give you breast cancer. It's going to give you a stroke. And we had to literally, like, people had to have failed like umpteen other medications for their menopause symptoms. They had to be like, basically like, oh, I'm begging for HRT. And then we would put people on it for like a few months or a year and then like take them off of it because we were scared. So that sort of colored how people thought about HRT for decades. And then including it got black box warnings, which is basically like the kind of the strongest warning that you can put on FDA-approved medications, basically saying that there are increased risks of certain cancers like breast cancer and endometrial, which is uterine cancer, like heart disease and dementia. And so the data from that big study then got reanalyzed in recent years. Because they basically glommed together everyone. Again, remember that the study is supposed to be about longevity and older women. So the average age of women in that study was 63, which is actually much older than the age when people are typically going through the worst of the symptoms, which is perimenopause, which is people are in like their 40s, like maybe like 50s. So these are younger women who have by nature a lower risk of these things. So they have a much lower risk of breast cancer, of heart disease, of strokes. But they were sort of being grouped together with women who are like, in their like 70s, 80s, like the average age in the study, like I said, was 63. So when they reanalyzed it based on age, they saw that the risks were much, much, much younger for women in general, and then even lower for women who are younger. And so the recent studies have also shown that timing matters and the age matters. So it makes a difference because if you start when you are younger, there's actually, a lower risk of cardiovascular disease. We think that it's because, you sort of get in there before you start to get some of these changes like plaques in the arteries in your heart. If you start after those plaques are already there, it's really not going to do very much. And then, some estrogens have a little bit of a higher risk of clots. And so you kind of add on top of what you already have risk-wise, a teeny bit more risk. And that's what's showing up in the big kind of press releases as like, quote unquote, an increased risk. So now we sort of realize, and the other big point about that study is it was only one type of HRT. People don't realize when we say, the hormone therapy, that we're talking about lots and lots of different medicines. They're given different ways. Some are given through skin, some are given through pill, and they all have different risk factors. So, for instance, the estrogens that are given by skin, like patches and gels, those of you who are on HRT, most of you are on those right now, don't have an increased risk of clots and strokes. They're metabolized in a different way than pills are. And then vaginal estrogen has basically no risks. So even for women with a history of hormone responsive breast cancer can take vaginal estrogen without increasing the recurrence risk. There's a very small subset, people on aromatase inhibitors that one study showed might have an increased risk. But basically, like I said, vaginal estrogen has almost no risks, at all. And, it's very different than a pill, then it's different from a patch. And the hormones that we're studying, the Women's Health Initiative, almost nobody uses anymore. It was something called Premarin and Prempro, which come from horses. It's pregnant mare urine. And so, it's not that it's not given anymore, but it's sort of fallen a little bit out of use because now we're using kind of what we call the bioidentical type that's identical to human estrogen. So, like I said, we're also comparing a little bit apples to oranges in the types of hormones that people were looking at and sort of extrapolated it to like literally everything. So the black box warning was recently taken off, in light of all of this. What remains is still for like systemic estrogens, like non-vaginal estrogen, there is still an increased risk of uterine cancer, of endometrial cancer. That is negated by giving progestin medications like progesterone that counteract it. So even that warning, if you are prescribing it correctly, is sort of a non-issue. So they're leaving it on there because there are some people who accidentally, and this sounds terrible, but they accidentally forget the progesterone part, and that does increase your uterine cancer risk. But those who are prescribing it right are not increasing your risk. So a lot of OBGYNs and women's health advocates were very excited about the removal of the black box warning, partly because it was sort of unnecessarily scaring everyone, especially when it came to vaginal estrogen. So, take away kind of the scare factor so that you can talk with your doctor about your particular risk of breast cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, et cetera, and then make a decision for you without just looking at the box and being like, oh, I can't take it.
That is really, really helpful. Yeah, that is something that has just been like rife with bad information over the years. Okay, so unfortunately, we are running out of time. I can't believe it. Is there like one thing or a couple things that you would like to say to educate people? Just if there's, I don't know, one thing to kind of wrap it up, is there something that you like to tell people?
Yeah, so I always like to leave it with just because something is common, it doesn't necessarily mean it's normal. And even if it's quote unquote normal, meaning that it's something that, isn't like terrible. It's not a disease. It's not something you have to suffer with. And so that includes perimenopause, menopause, includes, pain. If you are not getting answers and you're talking with your doctor, get a second opinion. There's always someone out there. For those of you who are searching for kind of menopause care, and you're having some difficulty finding someone, for instance, there's a provider directory, menopause.org. That's Menopause Society. And so they have a provider directory of people who, follow guidelines. You could go on and on. There's a whole kind of like, again, kind of fringe approach to hormones where they do things like pellets or compounded things, and they're doing stuff that's a little bit off the beaten path and that has some risk to it. So, Menopause Society has people who are kind of following evidence-based guidelines. So you can kind of trust, what they say overall. And then for people who don't have somebody who's nearby, like we talked about with the access issue, you can do telemedicine. So Genev, Genennev.
Yes, thank you. That is the good news. I
Always
mean,
bring it back to an optimistic place.
that was Dr. Karen Tang, author of It's Not Hysteria: Everything You Need to Know About Your Reproductive Health, But Were Never Told. Thank you all for listening. This has been Gulf Coast Life, and I'm your host, Carrie Barber. We had production help today from Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1. WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.